Well, hopefully the class is so invigorating that you just have a well of heat swelling up in you. So we don't have a specific particular reading tonight, but we will be flipping through a lot of passages. So we're going to be looking at the wilderness is the title. So when you think of the wilderness, what springs to your mind? I don't want you just to blurt out something just to fill the silence, but think about it and think about what comes to your mind when you think of wilderness or of the wilderness. And feel free, please, everyone on Zoom, if you've got something to say, just chime up.
Without the pleasures of this life and the distractions.
Okay.
Think of those like Paul who went into Arabia, or Christ who kind of escaped and faced, at least for Christ, temptation and trial.
Okay. Is that coming through on Zoom? All right. If anyone just can holler.
Fine.
Okay, good. Thank you. So is this something that you think of that is generic, wilderness, or something more specific? Do you think of, for example, say, the children of Israel specifically, or Paul, or is it just anywhere out in the wild for you? Do you think of the wilderness as a geographic location, such as, say, the Sahara Desert? Or do you think of wilderness as maybe just somewhere out near the Rockies? When you think of wilderness, do you think of, like, maybe a list of adjectives, like dry, or hot, or barren, or empty, or peaceful, or tranquil? Is it a mental picture? Is it imagery that comes into your mind? Maybe of sand dunes, of just endless, endless empty space and rocks and nothing alive, just maybe a random cactus or tumbleweeds. The sun just beating down relentlessly. Or do you think maybe of a forest meadow with dappled sunlight filtering through the tree canopy onto gently swaying grasses, quiet except for the chirping of the birds? Is it a concept maybe that comes into your mind, like trial or hardship or even death or solitude, refocus, invigoration? Now, I think actually all of these things are valid at different, perhaps different points in our lives or perhaps different examples that come to us out of Scripture. And the wilderness isn't just the children of Israel going through the wilderness out of Egypt. Although that seems to be the largest example we have, just in quantity of verses, it's a huge subject, spans, well, in some parts, or rather, almost the whole first five books, or certainly four of the first five books of the Bible. Huge subject. And there's good reason for that. But that's not the only wilderness that we have. That's not the only concept or idea of wilderness that we have throughout the Scriptures. So there's a couple of words in the Old Testament. There's about four or five different words which we have translated in the King James Version of the Bible into wilderness. And by far the most common is Midbar. And it's not very specific at all, actually. It's described as a pasture for driving cattle, perhaps. By implication from that, it's a desert. What's also interesting is the root for Midbar is Dabar, which is to arrange, and figuratively to arrange words or speech or teaching. So there's this implication of the wilderness to be a place of teaching or a place to be taught, which I think is actually quite powerful and quite telling. I think it's very interesting. So when we read wilderness, the word wilderness, primarily through the Old Testament, that's the word we're getting. There's a few others. Another one is Jeshimon. It's probably not pronounced exactly Jeshimon, but that's what we have in our English version of it. And there's a place, Jeshimon, which we read of in the life of David. It's only 13 times occurs, as opposed to the 300 odd, if I remember correctly, that Midbar occurs. And Jeshimon is a desolation. It's to lie waste. It's a whole nother level. So let's come to 1 Samuel. We have a few places in 1 Samuel where we read, we actually have the word the English word Jeshimon. So 1 Samuel 23 is our first reference. And 1 Samuel 23 is the context of David fleeing from Saul, and he's hiding, and verse 14, he's in the wilderness of Ziph. Verse 15, he's hiding in the wood. Verse 16, Jonathan, Saul's son, arises and just goes to David, which I think is one of, it's just such a beautiful picture that we get out of this. Saul is looking, he's scratching his head, he has no idea where David is, and Jonathan is able to just get up and go straight to him and strengthen his hand in God. As the phrase here is in verse 16. They make the covenant, verse 18. And then verse 19, the Ziphites, the betrayers, come to Saul to Gibeah, and they give David up. And they say, does not David hide himself with us in the strongholds, in the wood, in the hill of Hakilah, which is in the south of Jeshimon, which is this desolate desert. So this is the area that David is in. And I think it's literal a desolation, but I think it's probably there's some spiritual elements too of David at this point in his life, just the intense pressure that he faced being pursued by Saul. So again, also in verse 24, they arose, they went before to Ziph, went to Ziph before Saul, but David and his men were in the wilderness of Maon in the plain on the south of Jeshimon. So they're skirting around this desolate, desolate place, Jeshimon. And this is where they are, and Saul's men seek him, and he comes to the rock and pursues David in the wilderness here in verse 25. And of course, this, as a young Sunday school scholar, the excitement of verse 26 was always palpable when Saul's on one side of the mountain and David's fleeing around on the other side, and whoever my teacher was at the time, I can't remember, but they did a very good job of creating this image in my mind of, you know, maybe the music's playing like Zorro or dun, 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 and they're chasing each other around. And anyway, that's a bit of a digression. But here's David around this Jeshimon, this desolate place. Similar thing happens again a few chapters on in 1 Samuel chapter 26. We come in at verse 1 of the chapter. Again, the Ziphites, these same people, betray David. They come to Saul to Gibeah saying, does not David hide himself in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon? Saul arose, goes down to the wilderness of Ziph with 3,000 men to seek David in the wilderness. Saul pitches in the hill of Hakilah, which is before Jeshimon, by the way. But David's in the wilderness, and Saul comes after him into the wilderness. So this is Jeshimon. These are four of the only 13 times that this word occurs in all of the Old Testament. And it's this idea of just of desolation, of a waste, of a very difficult place to survive in. Interestingly enough, Jeshimon also occurs in the context of Balak and Balaam. I'll just read it out here. It's Numbers 23, for those who are taking notes. Numbers 23, 27, and 28. Balak says to Balaam, come, I pray thee, I will bring thee unto another place. Peradventure, it will please God that thou mayest curse me then from thence. And Balak brought Balaam up onto the top of Peor that looketh toward Jeshimon. So you can imagine, you know, they're up high, and they perhaps see down into this just waste, desolate desert place where the people of Israel, the children of Israel, were in. And one more, again, I'll just cite it for you again for people taking notes. Deuteronomy 32, verse 10. Of course, Deuteronomy, the end of Deuteronomy, is where Moses is recapping the events of the journey back to the children of Israel at the end of Deuteronomy there. So Deuteronomy 32, verse 10 says, he found him in a desert land. Desert, the first desert here is Midbar. He found him in a desert land and in the waste, howling wilderness, which is Jeshimon. He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of the eye, of his eye. And just keep this in mind, because I think this is a very, very important verse in the context of our whole study of the wilderness the second half of it there, when God finds him in the howling wilderness, he led him about, he instructed him, he kept him as the apple of the eye, and I think that's one of the keys. So there's a couple other words that are used quite infrequently. One, some of your versions might say Araba at times when you read through certain passages. You've probably heard that. That's another kind of term that's wilderness. And then there's another word that refers specifically to those who dwell in the wilderness, or living things in the wilderness. So sometimes it's people and sometimes it's beasts that dwell in the wilderness. So that's some of the words that we have, and I think there's some interesting things that we can get out of just a short little word study there. The idea of being taught or a place to be taught, I think is really interesting. And then the context of a desolate waste place, I think is also an interesting idea. So of course we've mentioned the elephant in the room, and maybe that's an appropriate, maybe it's not an appropriate analogy. But the biggest and the greatest example of the wilderness in the whole scriptures is, of course, the children of Israel and the wilderness. But who else can you think of who went into the wilderness or who had something to do with the wilderness or a wilderness?
Jesus after he's baptized.
Okay. Jesus, good.
Elijah
is another one, good.
John
the Baptist, is that your John? Yeah. We've got three more. There could be even more that I've got.
How about Moses after he left Egypt? I don't know if it's called.
That's a great one, yeah.
What about Paul after he's converted?
Paul's a lot was another one, that's good. And I've got one more that is kind of interesting that you might not think of. Philip goes down into the wilderness and meets the Ethiopian eunuch. So we're just going to spend a bit of time and look at these examples and just kind of see what we can glean out of people who either went into the wilderness, were led into the wilderness, were driven into the wilderness. But this idea of the wilderness and what we can learn from these examples of people. So, there's another one actually, which is interesting. On a prophetic level, in Revelation chapter 12, verses 6 and 14, the woman goes into the wilderness as a place of refuge to escape from, I believe it's the beast or the dragon. Or the dragon. So, anyway, that's just another kind of interesting one, that it's the wilderness in that context is a safe place to go, is a place to escape. And that's, I think, an interesting point, right? Because we talked about in our first little section of what do we think of when we think of the wilderness, and maybe it's all, you know, like dark and hot and persecuting. But maybe it's a refuge. Maybe the wilderness to us is a refuge. And I think it's both, and I think it can be a number of things, as I say, depending on our particular circumstances or at different times in our lives, it may manifest in different ways, so. Okay, so the first one, I don't have these necessarily in any particular order, but let's look at Paul first. So come over to Galatians chapter 1. So I think we were probably familiar a little bit with this. So we know Paul was persecuting the church. He was responsible for Stephen's death. And he drove people all away from Jerusalem in his persecution. He was on his way to Damascus to persecute more people. Of course, he saw Jesus in the blinding light. He was blinded for 3 days in Damascus. And at that time, the penny dropped, so to speak, and he really realized what he'd been missing, what he had failed to connect. And so then he's converted and he goes and he preaches and the Jews are like, this was our champion and now he's converted to the other side. So he realizes the position that he's in. So let's see, Galatians chapter 1. Let's just pick up verse 14. And profited in the Jews' religion above many my equals in mine own nation, being more exceedingly zealous of the traditions of my fathers, but when it pleased God, who separated me from my mother's womb and called me by his grace to reveal his son in me, that I might preach him among the nations. Immediately I conferred not with flesh and blood. So this is, of course, talking about his conversion we just mentioned in Damascus. It says, I did not confer with flesh and blood, neither did I go to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went into Arabia and returned unto Damascus. And after 3 years, then I went up to Jerusalem. So Arabia here, the Greek word means, well, it's of course Arabia, the location, but Arabia means desert or barren. So he goes. He doesn't go for advice or counsel with anyone else. He just goes off alone into the desert, into Arabia, which I think is interesting. Now, I'm not sure if this 3 years here in verse 18 is 3 years that he was in Arabia, or it was just 3 years in Arabia and Damascus, and then he went up to Jerusalem. I'm not sure that we have an exact timeline, but it was at some significant amount of time that Paul, he just had to go into the wilderness. That was what he needed to do at that point, directly following his conversion. And I think that's, I think it's interesting to think about that he didn't go to Jerusalem. He didn't sit down with the elders and, you know, hash things out or whatever. He needed alone time where he could go and he could be with God before he got into the ministry that he was to do. All right, so now let's turn to Acts chapter 8, which is the one that immediately jumps to our mind, which is Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. So Acts chapter 8, verse 26. The angel of the Lord spake unto Philip, saying, Arise, and go toward the south, unto the way that goes down from Jerusalem unto Gaza, which is desert. And it's in the desert that he, of course, comes across this Ethiopian eunuch. And what an amazing story. I mean, maybe it was common, but maybe it was really not common at all to run into someone else on this desert road. Maybe it was deserted in the desert. And it was really quite an unusual thing to see another person. And what a blessing by God to this unit that it was Philip who was the particular individual, obviously by design of God. But God sent Philip along to this man, to this eunuch. And he was reading something that he didn't understand, verse 30, and you know with the story. Philip preaches to him, and the end result then is verse 36. As they went down on the way, they came to certain water, and the eunuch said, "See, here is water. What does hinder me to be baptized?" And of course, he is baptized. So that's an incredible story that comes out of the desert here. All right, so let's talk a little bit about Moses. Now, we know a lot about Moses as the leader of the children of Israel. But before he ever got to be that man, first he needed a bit of wilderness on his own. So Exodus chapter 2 is where we begin. So the first half of the chapter is Moses being hidden in the river and Pharaoh's daughter coming to find him there and him being raised in the house of Pharaoh as Pharaoh's daughter's son. And he sees an Egyptian smiting a Hebrew, verse 11, and he goes and rescues his Hebrew brother and kills the Egyptian, which doesn't go over well with Pharaoh. And so when Pharaoh finds out, he flees. Verse 15, Pharaoh seeks to slay Moses, but Moses flees from Pharaoh and he dwells in the land of Midian. And so he's out of Egypt. He leaves Egypt and he goes into Midian. And then when we pick up the story, there's, you know, more here where he meets his wife and a bunch of people and so on. But chapter 3 and verse 1, Moses kept the flock of Jethro, his father, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back side of the desert and came to the mountain of God, even to Horeb. So he is way out there. Moses is like, not only is he out of Egypt into Midian, but now he's like at the back side of the desert. So he is far, far away, and this is where the Lord appears to him in the burning bush. And so this desert here is Midbar, is a place for the arrangement or the organizing of words. So he is taught here. And it's a powerful lesson that Moses needed to learn. I think it's Acts 7, maybe someone knows the particulars of the verse, where Moses is described as a man who is mighty in word and deed. It's either that or maybe it's in Hebrews 11. And maybe we kind of tend to forget that a little bit. The power, the eloquence, the wisdom, the knowledge, the skill, everything that Moses would have picked up as the son of Pharaoh's daughter in Egypt was not insignificant. He would have had literally the top education of his time that you could even imagine. I don't even know what it would be like. It would be like a double degree from Harvard and Yale and maybe Stanford too or something, and MIT. Like, the top of the top of education, he was described as mighty in word. Like, he was a powerful, powerful speaker and an extremely well-educated man. He was clearly physically capable as well, as he was able to kill the Egyptian man who was smiting the Hebrew. So he was a bit of a big deal. And he needed to unlearn all of that. So he had to go personally into the wilderness and to unlearn all those things and to be taught by God before he was ever able, or before God would ever allow him to come back and lead everyone else into the wilderness. So I think that's interesting. Moses himself had his own individual, personal wilderness wandering, if we want to use that term, before he was ever called to lead the nation through the wilderness. All right, let's talk a little bit about Elijah. So 1 Kings chapter 19. So I think we know a little bit about the character of Elijah, how he was quite a dramatic, intense, energetic guy. And he seems to go from spiritual highs to spiritual lows and back up again at the snap of a finger. So he's just hot off the heels of the very dramatic demonstration by God of his power with the altar up on top of Carmel, the contest on top of Carmel. And he's slain the prophets of Baal, and of course Jezebel is very displeased with that. And so Elijah is now going to flee for his life. Verse 3 in 1 Kings chapter 19, when he saw that, he rose and went for his life, came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah. He leaves his servant there, and he himself continues to go a day's journey into the wilderness, and he sits under a juniper tree. And that's not far enough. Just one day's journey into the wilderness. So an angel comes to him, verse 5, feeds him. Verse 6, there's a cake baking on coals and some water. The angel feeds him a second time, verse 7, and he arises in verse 8 and goes 40 days' journey into the wilderness. So he is, again, well and truly into the wilderness. He's not just hanging around on the outskirts. He's way in, and he comes to Horeb, to the mountain of God. Verse 9, he comes to a cave and lodges. And God comes to him there and asks him, what is he doing? And we have this same verse. Verses 10 and 14 are identical, word for word. And so Elijah lays his plight down to God. And, Elijah's searching for something. He's searching for answers. And verse 11 is where he begins to get his answers. And he goes out. God says to him, go forth and stand on the mount before the Lord. And the Lord passed by in a great and strong wind, and it rent the mountains and brake in pieces the rocks before the Lord. That is a wind. I mean, we've had some wind here where it breaks some waves, but I don't know if we've ever been in a wind that breaks rocks. That's incredible power. But the Lord is not in that wind, as we know. And after that, an earthquake. And standing on a mountain in the mouth of a cave when there's an earthquake is maybe a pretty sketchy place to be. But of course, the Lord is not in the earthquake, nor in the fire, in verse 12, but he is in the still, small voice. And so when Elijah hears that, he wraps his face in a mantle and comes out. and he finds what he's looking for. You know, I don't know that we can imagine the circumstances of Elijah's life, the craziness of it. But he's looking, and he's a fiery man, and he loves the fire coming down and smiting the altar and all this action. And God says, look, that's not what this is about. It's about this still, small voice. And Elijah needed to go 41 days into the wilderness to learn that lesson. And I think so hopefully we're starting to build a picture a little bit of when we look at the characters and what happened in their lives, that we can start to maybe get a sense of the wilderness, what the wilderness is all about. Mike, yeah.
Pete, do you know what you think about the connection between the wilderness and Horeb or Sinai? Because that, I mean, Moses, Elijah, and maybe even Paul, just tells us Arabic, seemed like there's not just a wilderness, but there's also where God gave Moses the commandments, God speaking to them. Do you know if there's a thought about a connection with, this one's focusing again on Horeb or Sinai as well. Like, it's wilderness, but way out there, but it also connects with that. I don't know if you've got any thoughts on that.
I don't personally have any grand, maybe someone else does, if there's maybe someone here or someone on Zoom who's got some greater wisdom than I. It seems that God does use that place. It seems that God does at times use specific place. I mean, of course, he chooses Jerusalem to place his name there. I'm not sure. It's an interesting thing. I personally, for me, I don't place value on certain places, but I think some people do, with memories or whatever it is. And God certainly picked Jerusalem as a place for his temple. I'm not sure. I don't have any.
Yeah. And there's, because all the other examples too are wilderness, but they're not.
Not specifically Horeb, yeah, yeah. Thanks. Right, so Elijah goes and he's looking for the earthquake, wind, and fire, but God is not on those things. And Elijah needed to learn the lesson of the still small voice. And the other thing that Elijah needed was a job. He needed to keep busy, so God gave him the three jobs that he had to do. Verse 15, go anoint Hazael king over Syria, Jehu king over Israel, and Elisha in his place. Sometimes that's just actually what we need, maybe. We just need to let go of the earthquake, wind, and fire in our lives and just get a job and get something to do, have a goal, have something to focus on, and just have that still, small voice, and that's good for us. Okay, so we talked a little bit about David in the wilderness with Saul, but there's one other passage I'd like to look at. I mean, David's an interesting one, and I don't know that we have a ton of specific references, but I think we can imagine the amount of time David spent in the wilderness just in his youth and, of course, running from Saul, and he just seems to be a very contemplative type of guy, which I believe is part of the lesson or the power of the wilderness. So anyways, let's go into 1 Samuel. So we're back a couple of books. First Samuel 17, which is the context of Goliath. And so let's go 1 Samuel 17 and let's pick it up. Where should we pick it up? Let's come in 28. So the background is that Goliath is the champion of the Philistines, and he goes out and he challenges Israel day after day. David goes to take some provisions to his brothers, who are on the front line, so to speak. Verse 28, Eliab, his eldest brother, heard when he spake unto the men, and Eliab's anger was kindled against David, and he said, "Why camest thou down hither? And with whom hast thou left those few sheep in the wilderness. I know thy pride and the naughtiness of thy heart, for there come down that thou mightest see the battle. So here's Eliab's perception of David. He was just off in the wilderness with a couple straggly sheep in the middle of nowhere. And it may not have been too far off the truth. I mean, I don't know if it's a few scraggly sheep, but I'm sure David was in the wilderness. He was alone. He was in a solitary place with his sheep. And I think it gave him an incredible insight into maybe himself, his own character, his own strengths and his own weaknesses. Certainly when we read the Psalms, we get just some absolutely beautiful pictures of the workings of his mind and how he thought and what he thought about. And I'm sure a lot of that was sitting, watching sheep. But it wasn't all watching sheep because sometimes he had to defend them. Verse 34, now David's talking to Saul. He says to Saul, "Thy servant kept his father's sheep, and there came a lion and a bear and took a lamb out of the flock. And I went out after him and smote him and delivered it out of his mouth. And when he arose against me, I caught him by his beard and smote him and slew him. Thy servant slew both the lion and the bear, and this uncircumcised Philistine shall be like one of them, seeing that he hath defied the armies of the living God." So the wilderness is a dangerous place also. He wasn't sitting out there on his picnic blanket, you know, with his cup of tea and a scone and some jam. You know, this is, the wilderness is an intense place. It's a place of danger, potentially significant danger. You know, Elijah was in a wilderness with earthquakes, wind, and fire. David's here with lions and bears. But it's the value of the wilderness far outweighs any danger or any risk that they faced. And maybe it's the wilderness that environment which taught them the lessons that they needed to learn to defeat those enemies, if that's an expression that we can use. And as we mentioned, then, of course, all the chapters, we've been going through this in Sunday school, so Mark could probably talk for about another 20 minutes or so about David in the wilderness. All right, so let's talk about John the Baptist. Over into Luke chapter 1, there's, of course, a number of passages that refer to this. I didn't necessarily pick Luke because it had anything more to say than the others, but Luke chapter 1, in the very, very last verse, talks about John. The child grew and waxed strong in spirit and was in the deserts till the day of his showing unto Israel. So he dwelt in the desert. So let's come into Matthew. We'll look at a couple other verses in respect to John. Matthew chapter 3. So Matthew chapter 3, verse 1, "In those days came John the Baptist preaching in the wilderness of Judea, saying, Repent ye, for the kingdom of heaven is at hand." So this is where he is, obviously. And then Jesus comments about this later in Matthew chapter 11. Matthew chapter 11 and verse 7. "So as they departed, Jesus began to say unto the multitudes concerning John, What went ye out into the wilderness to see?" So he asked them directly, why did you guys go out? I mean, this is the wilderness we're talking here. Why did you go out into the wilderness? What were you trying to see? A reed shaken with the wind? Obviously the answer is no, rhetorical. What went ye out to see? Were you looking for a man in soft raiment, you know, in fancy clothes? Behold, those that wear soft clothing are in king's houses. But seriously, verse 9, what did you go out to see? A prophet? Yes, I say unto you, and more than a prophet. For this is he of whom it is written, Behold, I send my messenger before thy face, which shall prepare thy way before thee. Verily I say unto you, among them that are born of women, there hath not risen a greater than John the Baptist. Notwithstanding, he that is least in the kingdom of heaven is greater than he." And I think there's some power in this here. We know John, we know he had a leather girdle and he ate bugs, he ate locusts and wild honey, and just is a character that I think we've probably in Victoria In 2022, we have a very difficult time relating to someone like that. I'm sure we would just think that person was crazy, just stark raving mad to just wear like a leather belt and eat bugs and honey. Like, but the reality is this is the man that God chose to prepare the way for his son. I think there's power in that. The way John lived, where he lived, his behavior was chosen by God to teach people and to prepare people for the coming of his son. And, I mean, I don't know what more to say. It's like, I'm sure there's probably a whole class we could do just on that idea of preparing for Jesus. And if we, you know, if we seek to be prepared for Jesus, are we, like, do we live in the wilderness? Do we live in a scant existence of maybe subsistence or barely surviving? You know, in an inhospitable place, is that how we prepare for our encounter with the Lord? Maybe not, if we're honest. But maybe we could take a little from that. it's not a call for us to like go and grab some leather skirts and head out and eat locusts. But I'm sure there's some deep and profound spiritual lessons in that. Out of all the people that God had chosen, the voice crying in the wilderness, right, to prepare the way of the Lord, this is what that looked like. Was a wild man eating bugs and honey. Mike?
And again, to follow your theme, it seems like they had to go to the wilderness to get this new message. That was where they had to find it. They had to go to him.
That's a good point. Absolutely, that's a great point. They didn't go to the temple, you know, or wherever they thought that, or the synagogue, or the Sanhedrin, or the rulers, or whatever. This was the wilderness. God said, "This is where it will be. You have to endure this. You have to go out." And it was, it wasn't someone who was very well dressed and polished and presented and a very skilled orator, and you know, it wasn't that, and it wasn't a pretty picture of reeds, you know, gently blowing in the wind. I'm sure there's maybe some other messages out of what it wasn't as well, the reed shaken in the wind. There's some indication with the shaking of the wind that ties in with, is it James 1, about being tossed to and fro with every wind of doctrine. There's a sense that a reed is not a very strong, you can't use a reed as a staff because it just breaks. There's no substance to a reed. So I'm sure there's that as well. Other parables or lessons that come out of that. And then, of course, we come to Jesus, who is perhaps outside of the, you know, four full chapters of the first five books that talk about being in the wilderness, Jesus is perhaps the second most frequent user of the wilderness. So I've just grabbed a few out of Mark, and I'm sure there are, it's hard to tell sometimes which are parallel accounts or different accounts in the different gospels of the same event or which are unique events. But we'll pick out a few here because there's a lot. So we'll start in Mark chapter 1. Mark chapter 1 and verse 35. Well, even before that, I guess the verses before that. Verse 32, and even when the sun did set, they brought unto him all that were diseased and possessed with devils, and all the city was gathered together at the door, and he healed many that were sick of divers diseases and cast out many devils, and suffered not the devils to speak because they knew him. And just think of that, like the pressure with the whole city is just bearing down on him. And verse 35, in the morning, rising up a great while before day, he went out and departed into a solitary place, and there prayed. And you know, maybe we can imagine this. Maybe in our minds we can get some sort of picture of just the throng and the multitude and the pressure and the intensity and probably people yelling and just this chaos. And he's healing and he's doing everything he can, and he just has to get away. And it's like early in the morning, he says, before, like a great while before day. I don't even know, what is that? Is that 3 in the morning? A great while before day? I guess where I grew up in Prince George, if it's in the winter, I think 8 o'clock is a great while before day because you only get a few hours of sunlight. But it's a great while before day. He goes out, and then and he prays, and he prays long enough for everyone. He's there praying or meditating, whatever, for long enough that in verse 36, when they finally the rest of the people wake up and get their day started, verse 36 and 37, they head out. And trying to find him, and he says, okay, we got to go into the next towns, and he needs that time of silence, of quiet, of separation from everything. It was so important for Jesus to be in the wilderness. And so this is maybe where we start to see the other side of the wilderness from the children of Israel and fiery serpents and no water, where Jesus needed the wilderness as a place of solitude and refuge to just, to decompress, to gather himself and to pray and to be with his Father for strength to just go on and go through the next day.
Are not all these wildernesses uninhabited? Basically uninhabited?
I think
is that not
yes.
the point?
Yes, I think that is the point, that there's no one there. They're alone. Thanks for that. So Mark chapter 6... and verse 46. this is the feeding of the 5,000. Verse 44, 5,000. So again, just the intensity of that moment and the emotional drain or just the focus and the concentration and everything that's going on, the energy. Verse 45, straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship. So there's again, Mark always has urgency in his gospel. Straightway he constrained his disciples to get into the ship and to go to the other side before unto Bethsaida. While he sent the people away, and when he had sent them away, he departed into the mountain. It doesn't say specifically wilderness here, but it's the same concept. That he just went away and he went to pray. I'm not sure how long it was, but it was even, verse 47, when even was come, the ship was in the midst of the sea. So he was there for a passage of time. It wasn't just a 5-minute kind of thing. So again, he's got to get away. He goes into the wilderness. Oh, I'm a little out of order on my passages here. The same chapter, Mark 6, back in verse 31 and 32. So here the disciples, verse 30, the apostles gathered themselves together to Jesus and told him all the things that they had done and what they had taught. I guess this is in the context of Jesus sending them out to preach. And this is also following the death of his cousin, John the Baptist, right? Verse 24. So verse 31, all of this weight, right? The excitement and the need of the apostles for support and they're coming to tell him everything that happened. He's got to support them. His cousin has just been brutally executed, beheaded. So verse 31, he says to them, come ye yourselves apart into a desert place and rest a while. Yeah, no kidding. For there were many coming and going and they had no leisure so much as to eat. And they departed into a desert place by ship, privately. So they just need to go and get away. Verse 35, and when the day was now far spent, his disciples came unto him and said, this is a desert place, and now the time is far spent. And of course, they want to send them away, but Jesus feeds them there. This is the feeding of the 5,000. So there's 5,000 people, besides women and children, who went into the wilderness to follow Jesus, which I think is, again, kind of part of what we're talking about in our theme here, where people, they went out into the wilderness. We're getting a bit short on time, but I'll cite it because I'm sure we're familiar with it. Immediately after, I think someone actually even mentioned it, immediately after Jesus was baptized, and I think one of, or two of the Gospels say he was led of the Spirit into the wilderness. I think one of them says he was driven by the Spirit into the wilderness. So immediately after he comes up out of the waters of baptism, the dove ascends upon him, and then he is out into the wilderness. And he eats nothing for 40 days, and he's tempted of the devil. We know that. I think we're pretty familiar with that situation. But so that's a time when the wilderness or when the desert is a place of testing, is a place of trial. And it was necessary for him to go there. Of course, he was led or driven, depending on the particular gospel you read. It was critical for him to go into the wilderness at that time. So we'll maybe try and draw this together a little bit now. So do you have a solitary place or a wilderness that you can go?
We're constantly in the wilderness. We're constantly in the wilderness in our lives. We're going through that time of testing and so on. And it's only with the emergence of Christ will that wilderness disappear and be replaced by fertile lands, we hope, and pray and believe.
Yeah, that's a fair point, Jack. This life is a trial. There's absolutely no question of that. that's in many ways out of our control. By stepping into the waters of baptism and committing our lives to Jesus, we've basically taken that on, and those challenges come in waves of whatever God decides. So do we have a place of solitude that we can go? Do we have our mountaintop? Do we have our early morning retreat that we can go? Maybe we do. Maybe we have somewhere very specific. Maybe we just have a corner and a window and a cup of coffee or something, or tea or whatever it is. But I think we've seen from this that it's very important for us to have some sort of solitary place, kind of the good wilderness, not the bad wilderness, if I can use that type of a phrase. To separate ourselves, to be away from everything, to be able to just put all the stress and all the pressure aside for a while. And whether it's specifically praying or whether it's meditating or reading scriptures or whatever it is, to be able to be close enough to God to absorb some of his, you know, some of his wisdom and some of his strength from the passages of scripture to be able to get through this day and hopefully the next one too. And maybe we're strong, and maybe it's weeks at a time or whatnot, but it's really important for us to be able to have our solitary place that we can go to. I think we've learned that. I think a lot of these examples are pretty clear on that is critical for us to have. If it was critical for Jesus, I think that we have nowhere near the strength of him. And if he needed to, then I think it's a good lesson for us.
There's two aspects of the wilderness that we have to be careful on. Psalm 73 verse 17 doesn't talk about the wilderness, but it talks about looking at the world and being somewhat confused or upset with how, you know, people seem to be getting away with everything and enjoying their lives. And he says, until I went into the sanctuary of God, then I understood their ends. So it's about being in God's house, that you're able to perceive and look past the challenges of this life. And then in Luke 11, Jesus gives a parable. And he talks about the wilderness. It isn't called wilderness. In Luke 11, verse 24, when the unclean spirit's gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest and finding none. And so he returns to his house, and of course he's worse than he was. And so that's the other side of the coin, which is, you know, he's out in this wilderness, and he's looking for rest. And that's not where you're going to receive rest. In the wilderness, you will be tempted. Well, you'll be tried, not necessarily tempted, because God tempts no one, but you'll be tried. And so he's looking for rest. So you have these two kind of oxymorons almost, where wilderness is this place of refuge, but it's not a place of rest.
Hmm.
And so there's a little bit of a balancing game, because Christ definitely needed that moment to get away from the crowds and specifically to work with his disciples. And to pray to his Father, to re-strengthen himself. But it wasn't what this man was looking for, rest, you know, a vacation. Right?
Yeah.
So there's this balancing act where we can't treat the wilderness as this, you know, I gotta get away from all this stuff.
It's not a destination.
It's not a destination. It's a journey, but it is a release from these other pressures. And there's pressures to be different, like it could be the world, but or in Christ's case, it could be the pressure to make him king, right? And the inability for him to focus on a few disciples, right? So there are these reasons to, you know, excuse yourself in the crowd, but we can't. Human nature intrudes on us one way or another. We're like, oh, I want to retreat. I want to get away from all this hubbub. But you know, your escape could be the ecclesia, right? Psalm 73. I mean, that could you're escaping the world around you. However, if you come into the ecclesia and all the hubbub, that won't provide that, right? So you just, you know, we have to always be careful how we interpret it. Now, I think everything you're saying is correct. It's just, you know, if we interpret the wrong way, we can fall into this, you know, parable, this trap where we're looking for rest, and of course, we're not actually going to find it there.
Yeah, and I think with all these people, they didn't stay, right? Paul went into the wilderness to refocus, and then he came back, right? Jesus went into the mountain and into the solitary place to refocus, and he came back. Moses came back. And Elijah came back. He came out of it with a task to do, with jobs to do. So it's a refocusing as opposed to, like, it's not Club Med. Is Club
Sometimes
Med exist anymore?
Coming back wasn't voluntary either.
Sorry?
Sometimes the coming back wasn't voluntary.
That's a good point. That's a good point with Moses.
Moses didn't want the job that God gave him. He thought of every excuse he could. And eventually God gave him his brother to give him some moral support and be the orator. But there's very few of God's servants actually volunteered the job.
We're chomping at the bit to...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Most of them were trying to get out of it.
Yeah.
Like Jonah was a good example too.
And, Jonah, yeah, exactly.
Most of them.
Yeah. All right. So we do have this kind of two sides of the coin, right? The wilderness can be a place of danger, of fiery serpents, of drought, of Amalekites, of cruel enemies, and so on. But the wilderness can be also a place of calm, a place of peace, of rest, and renewal, so we can get back, back into the yoke, so to speak. And I think the difference can be our perspective. And we think of the children of Israel, the border of the land, the first time, and they sent the 12 spies in. And 10 of them came back and said, like, forget this. There's giants and all this kind of stuff. And yeah, there's like abundance like we can't even imagine. It takes two of us to carry the grapes, but there's giants and we can't do it. And of course, it appears almost it's only Caleb at first. And then later Joshua stands with him and says, they're bread for us. Like, with God on our side. They saw the same thing, but their perspective was quite different. All right, so let's just see if we can get a couple lessons out of this quickly. So I'll just read a section here out of Deuteronomy chapter 8, verses 10 to 17. Of course, Moses talking to the people. He says, when you have eaten and you are full, then thou shalt bless the Lord thy God for the good land which he has given thee. Beware that thou forget not the Lord thy God. So this is you don't go into the wilderness for enjoyment. That you forget not the Lord your God in keeping his commandments and his judgments and his statutes which I give you this day. Lest when thou hast eaten and art full and hast built goodly houses and dwell therein, and when thy herds and thy flocks multiply and thy silver and thy gold is multiplied and all that thou hast is multiplied, then thine heart be lifted up and thou forget the Lord thy God which brought thee forth out of the land of Egypt from the house of bondage, who led thee through that great and terrible wilderness wherein were fiery serpents and scorpions and drought where there was no water, who brought thee forth water out of the rock of flint, who fed thee in the wilderness with manna, which thy fathers knew not. And here's the key, that he might humble thee and that he might prove thee to do thee good at thy latter end. And thou say in thy heart, my power and the might of my hand have gotten me this wealth. So the wilderness is a tool used by God to humble and to teach. And I think we've kind of gone through that. It's essentially in the definition of the word. So if we don't use the lessons we learn, the trials, the difficulties in our lives as a lesson to be humbled by them, then we're completely missing the point of the wilderness. The wilderness is not a Club Med vacation. Does Club Med even exist anymore? I know that's kind of the word we use, but I'm not sure if it even exists. It's not a holiday. The wilderness is real and it's serious. Our lives are full of struggle. They're full of tragedy, of disappointment, of fear, of malevolence, of hopelessness. Our lives are hard. And we need something greater than the difficulty to offset that. And of course, that is the parable. If you look at a very high level view of the wilderness and the promised land, our focus and our desire for the promised land, for the righteousness of God to fill this earth, has to be bigger to us than all of the hardships that we will face. It's the only way we'll get through the wilderness, because if we look at the numbers, most people did not get out of the wilderness. That's just what we read. They all died except for Caleb and Joshua and those who were under 20, because they couldn't maintain that division, that vision of the promised land. And so that's a huge lesson for us, because if we look at the numbers, it's not in our favor, and it's sobering. But so that's a key point too, also, to maintain that focus and the vision of where we're going. Because if we lose that and we just start to look around us at the fiery serpents and the drought, we're in big trouble. Another lesson. We don't get to go from bondage in Egypt to paradise. That road does not exist. We have to go through the wilderness. And as difficult as it is, that's a fundamental truth of our lives. We don't get to go from the pleasures of Egypt to the pleasures of God's kingdom without first going through the wilderness. And I've got another one here, and I don't know if we've really got time to discuss it, but I wanted to get some feedback. There's only one way out of the wilderness, and that is death. And it's going to sound funny, and I was hoping we'd have a bit more time to chat about it. It's either our death, it's either eternal death in the wilderness, like many or most of the children of Israel, or it's the death of the old man that dies in the wilderness so that we can enter the promised land. There's only one way out of the wilderness, and that is death. It's either our death or the death of the old man. And I think if we go through the list of people who went into the wilderness, I think we can maybe tease that out. And I say, unfortunately, we don't have too much time to chat about that. But I'll pick Philip, for example. The way out of that wilderness was for the spiritual, symbolic death of that Ethiopian eunuch down into the water. David got out of the wilderness in one way, you look at it, by the death of Saul. Jesus is got out of the wilderness temptation by the death of the devil. He killed the devil. It's maybe an obscure sort of argument, but I think it would be, it's an interesting conversation. Maybe we can chat after about it. Here I actually had some notes on that. So Paul needed to put to death his stubbornness and his adherence to the law. So that's what he went to Arabia to do. He had to put that to death. Elijah had to put to death his depression and his pride. Jesus had to put to death the tempter, and Moses had to put to death Egypt in himself personally first. All the wisdom of Egypt. And in one sense, we could say that it's either us or Og. One's got to die. So, anyway, that's maybe not the most cheerful note to end on, but. Hopefully there's something interesting there for us to chew over.